Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, May 20th. I'm Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, a multi-agency law enforcement operation has seized $123 million worth of illegal cannabis. The Klamath River Fund awards $1.2 million for Klamath Basin restoration and resilience. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming up. A multi-agency law enforcement operation has seized $123 million worth of illegal cannabis. In its largest operation to date, the state's Unified Cannabis Enforcement Task Force conducted an operation in the Central Valley, leading to the seizure of 22,000 pounds of processed cannabis and 105,000 plants. More than 200 officers and staff from 15 state, local, and federal agencies coordinated the operation through Kern, Kings, and Tulare counties, an area of about 4,600 square miles. A total of 71 search warrants were served and 9 firearms were confiscated. Throughout the course of the operation, numerous individuals were detained and several arrests were made. According to a press release, agencies are working with local district attorney's offices to file charges and pursue prosecutions. In addition to cannabis, officers found evidence of banned or restricted pesticides at several locations. The chemicals pose an environmental threat to California's native species, plants, and habitats, and present health risks to those who ingest cannabis laced with these products. Governor Gavin Newsom said, quote, "Let this be a reminder to all those who grow cannabis illegally. We won't tolerate the undermining of our legal industry and impacts to our environment. I appreciate the multi-agency, cross-county efforts to take on this illicit market." End quote. Recently, the Klamath River Fund announced $1.2 million in grants to support Klamath Basin restoration and resilience. The fund is run by the Humboldt Area Foundation, which is located in Bayside, Humboldt County. The Humboldt Foundation has been serving the North Coast since 1973, providing grants to entities and individuals in Humboldt, Del Norte, and Trinity counties in California and Curry County in Oregon. However, this is the first time the Klamath River Fund hands out grants. The $1.2 million awarded goes to projects that span the gamut, from youth training and education, building trails and recreational facilities, to flow studies and restoration of rivers in the Klamath Basin. We spoke to Craig Tucker at the Humboldt Area Foundation about the fund, which sprang out of the role the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation played in the historic Klamath Dam removals.
Last year was a really big year for fish enthusiasts here on the North Coast. We pulled off a decades-long campaign led by the tribes of this region to remove 4 relatively large dams. In fact, it's the biggest dam removal that we know of, planned dam removal in history, the biggest salmon restoration project in history. It'll give salmon access to over 400 miles of stream that they once spawned and reared in before the dams were built. And it just creates a lot of opportunity to start rebuilding this fishery. A lot of the activities over the years were funded by a lot of different private funders, but the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation really contributed a lot. And as dam removal occurred, the Hewlett Foundation thought, well, let's start a legacy that follows behind dam removal. And the folks who knows best of what we need to do next are locals. And so they got in touch with the Humboldt Area Foundation and kindly gifted $10 million to Humboldt Area Foundation to set up the Klamath River Fund. And since then, some other funders have gotten in on the act. And now Planet the River Fund has grown to about $14 million, and the fund is designed to last for the next decade, and it's really to take full advantage of the opportunity of dam removal, to sort of help as these fish sort of reconnect the communities along the Klamath River. So we want to help communities develop climate resilience, so projects that help communities withstand the swings from drought to flood, wildfire, all these things that are brought on by climate change, help rural communities be more resilient in the face of that. An investment in river restoration in these rural communities is an investment in their economies. It's an investment in improving human health outcomes. And it slowly but surely starts to address some of the unfair decisions, some of the inequitable decisions that have been made in the past over natural resources issues.
Grant recipients include American Rivers for restoration of the Little Shasta River, the Favel Museum in Klamath Springs that is doing an exhibit on the role of water in the Klamath Basin, and the Mid-Klamath Watershed Council working on youth programming and community engagement.
These grants kind of all meet or address the goals that I was describing with climate resilience, economic benefits, fisheries restoration, and they all sort of cue off the opportunity by afforded by dam removal. And it's really a diverse group of organizations. Kind of on the one end of it, we have the Klamath Drainage District, which is one of the irrigation districts as part of the Klamath Irrigation Project. Way up in Oregon, sort of at the headwaters where the Klamath begins. They're doing work to restore wetlands. They're collaborating with tribes from downriver on that work, doing work to restore wetlands to the benefit of waterfowl and suckers, endemic fish in that region, and help promote community access to be able to see and view the wildlife up there. Kind of on the other end of the spectrum, we're funding Paddle Tribal Waters. It's a group of tribal youth that I've been training for several years to have the skills to kayak the full length of the undammed Klamath. And that'll happen this summer. And so they're going to boat the whole reach of the river. They're going to tell the story of the campaign to remove Klamath River dams, and sort of create an event that'll bring a lot of international attention. And these guys have gone out and trained. They go out and train and do their kayaking on rivers all over the world. And as they go out and meet folks and communities from all over the world, they share the story of the Klamath and hopefully inspire folks in other places to do similar things to restore their watershed.
This is not the first time the words paddle tribal waters floats over the Kmart airwaves. You can find our special on the trip the Indigenous Kayak Club is taking down the river at kmart.org or by searching The First Descent, The Klamath Runs Free, on your favorite podcast platform. Back to our interview with Craig Tucker. Way before he took on his role as a communications director for the Humboldt Area Foundation, he had been involved in the Undam the Klamath movement.
I got to spend the last two decades on the Bring the Salmon Home campaign, working with tribal leaders from the Karuk tribe and the Yurok tribe and the Klamath tribes and Hoopa tribe. And it's been a wild ride. I think I had known when I started 20 years ago it was going to take 20 years. Maybe I would have had second thoughts, but I think that's why tribal folks are the right ones to really lead these campaigns, because I think a lot of nonprofit organizations and folks who work with nonprofit organizations kind of come and go. The tribes aren't going anywhere, and they're going to fight for this place from now until the end of time. Well, when these dams were built, tribal communities weren't consulted. The United States did not have laws or regulations that obligated state and federal agencies to worry about tribal resources and impacts to tribal people. And that's slowly changing. So, to the extent that we can fund projects that are tribally led, or we can fund projects where organizations are partnering with tribes, We're looking for things like that, and we really do support tribal self-determination. We think Native people have a right to govern themselves, and we want to support that. And so you'll see that reflected in our giving. Our focus areas for the fund is sustainable agriculture. So we do think, and I think the Klamath Dam removal in many ways is a reflection of partnerships that were forged between commercial and sport fishermen, tribal communities, conservation organizations, and agricultural communities. We saw upwards of 10,000 fish swim past what was once Iron Gate Dam this past year. So figuring out how to better monitor and respond to those fish, figure out where the fish want to go, restore those habitats, will be the way that we measure success. And we think we're well on our way to that.
Despite strong indications that the Klamath Dam removals have been a success, skepticism about the benefits remains.
Well, there was near unanimous agreement among water quality experts and fisheries experts that dam removal would benefit the ecosystem of the Klamath. And although it'll take years to really understand the benefits, I can tell you what we already know. We already know that water temperatures are colder in the Klamath in the summer with dams out, and that's really good for salmon. I can tell you that right now we're monitoring for fish disease in the Klamath the way we have for the last over a decade, and we're seeing a dramatic decrease in fish disease-causing parasites in the Klamath after dam removal. And we know that thousands, literally thousands of salmon are now spawning in areas they haven't been in a century. So, the evidence right now suggests that dam removal is working, and we have to keep monitoring it. We have to be responsive to what the fish are trying to tell us. But in other examples around the planet, when you remove dams, the ecosystem and the fish typically exceed expectations. And that's exactly what, I don't think any of the most optimistic of us thought that we'd have thousands of salmon swimming past what was once Iron Gate Dam weeks after we removed the dam. And that's exactly what happened. Here in the Klamath, we continue to lead with good news stories. It's removing dams, it's restoring salmon, it's bringing back condor, it's tribes leading on prescribing cultural burning. There's a lot of good things happening here in our region, and it's a testament to the communities in this region and the leaders we have in this region who make these things happen.
That was Craig Tucker of the Humboldt Area Foundation. Joan Auger with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families warns that pending Medicaid cuts could have serious consequences for medical services in rural areas. Susan Potter reports.
The Republican-controlled House of Representatives is hashing out last-minute details of a huge funding bill that could come to a floor vote this week. Advocates warn that proposed Medicaid cuts could force layoffs or closure of rural hospitals. The Trump administration is looking for savings to fund his tax cuts, which primarily benefit the wealthy. Joan Auger with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families says rural hospitals are often the only maternity ward for hundreds of miles.
It doesn't matter who their health insurer. If they have private insurance, employer insurance, but there's no facility, then they can't safely give birth. And that's why these issues are so consequential.
In order to cut the cost of Medicaid, known as Medi-Cal in the Golden State, Republicans are considering drastic cuts to states like California that fund health care for low-income undocumented immigrants. They are also looking at decreasing access by adding work requirements and by requiring states to verify eligibility more often. Alexis Heaton with California Coverage and Health Initiatives says by some estimates, up to 13 million Californians could lose coverage, and that prospect worries patients and providers who rallied in front of Dignity Health Mercy Hospital last week in Folsom.
This hospital is potentially going to shut down and lay off, I think they said, up to 2,000 people, and is the number one facility that treats folks in El Dorado County seeking maternity care.
Eva Rivera with the Children's Partnership says the cuts would be widely felt.
In the rural areas of California, half of all births are being covered by Medicaid. In California, 27% of women ages 19 to 40 rely on Medicaid for health insurance. So a good portion of the population is depending on this care.
Rivera adds that primary care funded by Medi-Cal saves money in the long run because it treats conditions as they develop, which prevents expensive emergency care later on.
Sticking with health-related news, a new study shows that more than 240,000 hospitalizations in California were potentially preventable through high-quality outpatient services. Susan Potter again.
Researchers say most of those patients had poorly controlled chronic conditions like diabetes, heart disease, or COPD. Rhonda Smith is executive director of the California Black Health Network, which co-sponsored the report. She says her organization helps patients learn to advocate for themselves.
I can't tell you countless stories that we hear about patients who just are not listened to and then end up being hospitalized or misdiagnosed.
The report shows that patients who rely on Medi-Cal or are Black, Native American, or English language learners are affected the most. The report finds the state could save $400 million a year if Medi-Cal members had the same rate of preventable hospitalizations as people with private insurance. Karen Savage-Sangwan is with the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network, also a co-sponsor of the report.
Each preventable hospitalization has a significant cost to the system, and that's the cost that's ultimately borne by all of us, right? By all healthcare consumers. We pay for our insurance. Those rates are determined by how much money is being spent in hospitals, et cetera. So it comes at a cost.
The report authors suggest policymakers resist calls to cut Medicaid nationally and to eliminate coverage for undocumented people in California. They also recommend hiring more culturally and linguistically responsive primary care physicians.
And Susan Potter brings home her trifecta with this report on potential destructive changes to the Endangered Species Act.
On the 20th anniversary of Endangered Species Day, conservation advocates warn that Trump administration policies are undermining efforts to save animals and plants important to California ecosystems. Trump's Department of the Interior wants to redefine the word harm to remove protection from habitat destruction in deciding which species are at risk. Susan Holmes with the Endangered Species Coalition.
The number one reason that endangered species become endangered is destruction of habitat. And the proposals coming from the Trump administration would make it impossible to protect the habitat that wildlife and endangered species depend on.
Trump appointees have also proposed huge budget cuts to agencies that oversee wildlife protection and to environmental research, saying they no longer align with administration priorities. In California, 178 animals and 290 plants are either listed as endangered or threatened or are candidates for listing. Many local events are planned for Endangered Species Day, including programs at Dos Rios State Park and the Cabrillo Marine Aquarium. Holmes says it's a good time to celebrate the incredible progress the country has made to reestablish species like the gray wolf.
In California, we've seen species that were on the brink of extinction coming back, including the California condor and the California sea otter. And it is really exciting to see people working in communities to recover some of these species.
Also on Monday, the public comment period ends for a proposal to list the monarch butterfly as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The trade war with China is impacting supply chains for many industries and is hitting companies that provide plastic alternatives especially hard. Isobel Charlet reports from Oregon.
Tariffs are disrupting supply chains from China, making it harder for reusable alternatives to compete with single-use plastics. Jeffrey Delkin is the president of Bamboo, an Oregon-based company that has been making plastic-free home goods for 20 years. He says the Trump administration's 145% tariffs force the company to lay off their staff in China and make their U.S. staff part-time. Though Chinese tariffs will now drop to 30% for 90 days, Delkin notes this is still a huge jump from the usual annual 3.5%. He fears the tariff roller coaster threatens the company's future as well as the market for plastic alternatives.
Unfortunately, this is a time where we need more small, right-minded, responsibly operated businesses, and the current conditions are not helping.
Data shows even before the trade war, plastic products face much lower tariffs than their alternatives. This keeps plastic prices low and makes it harder for alternatives to compete. Delkin adds, since the oil industry receives large government subsidies, plastic producers are better able to absorb extra costs. Research shows plastics contain harmful chemicals that leach into food, water, and the environment. Emissions created during plastic production also contribute to climate change. Delkin says the public is still learning about the impacts of microplastics on overall health, adding over 90% of the plastic that's produced ends up in landfills.
It's that kind of stark reality that encouraged us to really promote renewable materials.
The plastic market continues to grow despite these harmful impacts. In 2020, about 370 million tons of plastic were traded, valued at $1.2 trillion.
As prescribed, the burns become more commonplace on the California North Coast. Washington State is taking steps to follow the Golden State's lead. Isabel Charlet again.
Washington lawmakers have created a new prescribed burn liability fund that will make controlled burns less risky on public, private, and tribal lands across the state. Advocates say these low-intensity fires, which clear dead vegetation and small trees, are among the best tools to reduce wildfire severity, but fears of runaway fires have limited their use. Cody Desitel is the executive director for the Cauvil Tribe and helped write the bill to create the fund. He says although there is risk, data from the Forest Service and other agencies show controlled burns are very safe.
They pull off 99.84% of their burns within prescription, within the planned footprint. So the risk of it is really low, but for the rare occurrences you see it, the cost can be fairly high.
Desitel says a century of fire suppression has increased burnable materials in forests, causing more intense wildfires. Indigenous people have practiced controlled burns for millennia, Desitel adds, to both prevent fires and promote plant growth. To reduce wildfire damage, he says the state needs a new approach.
We're going to have to shift our perspective, how we deal with fire, how we create fire resilience, and it has to be suppression in combination with fuels and forest health treatments that makes fires easier to manage.
Representative Adam Birnbaum from Port Angeles sponsored the bill to create the liability fund. He says when fires are bigger and harder to control, along with loss of life and property, it can also make things more expensive for communities living close to forest land.
The rising property insurance rates there make it challenging for low-income, middle-income people across the state.
Birnbaum hopes the new policy will help bring down insurance rates for homeowners and encourage more people to get certified to implement prescribed burns. He says the fund should be up and running by the beginning of 2026. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Susan Potter and Isabel Charlet. I'm Sigrid Bjørn. Thank you for listening.
KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org.